You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
Let's talk about North One Bank, because a non-protected, basically a non-password protected database that contained a large number of PDF documents was exposed to the world, thanks to Jeremiah Fowler for discovering this one and alerting all of us. But heads up to you, if you use North One Bank, you might have very sensitive information sitting in PDF form that anybody could access for quite some time. You want to check in. I don't have much more. I'll let you know when they declare. Moving on, let's talk about Adelanto Healthcare Ventures, or AHCV. This is another healthcare breach. Vendor breach. Outstanding. Now, according to the breach notices, AHCV became aware of suspicious activity in their environment on November 5th of 2021. That's right. We're about going, what, almost 2 years back at this point? Year and a half? 2 years back? Now, further investigation revealed that an unauthorized party had access to employee email accounts via a phishing scam, and thanks to this, now a whole bunch of hospitals and whatnot have to actually declare. And so let's go through the list, because of right now, as of the last 2 weeks, we've got Texoma Medical Center, Coral Shows Behavioral Health, The Vines Hospital, Northwest Texas Healthcare System, Suncoast Behavioral Health, South Texas Health System, Doctors Hospitals of Laredo, and Fort Duncan Regional Medical Center. I'll let you know as more declare, but healthcare every week, I swear to God, is like half of these or more. Moving on. Let's head on over to Taiwan and talk about Taiwanese PC parts maker known as MSI. You might have one of their gaming laptops. They're pretty good. Now, MSI basically has been listed on the extortion portal of a new ransomware gang known as Money Message. I mentioned them in an earlier one, which claims to have stolen the source code from the company's network. Now, they're a global hardware giant. They make everything: motherboards, graphics cards, desktops, laptops, servers, industrial systems, PC peripherals, blah, 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 blah. They basically are worth about $6.5 billion, so they are pretty huge. Now, the threat actor listed MSI on their leak site and posted screenshots of what they claim to be the hardware vendor's CTMS and ERP databases and files containing software source code, private keys, and BIOS firmware. Obviously, that's a huge thing. You can start infecting the firmware, then you can wipe, you know, Windows or whatever off that machine till the cows come home, and you're still infected. So, not a good sign. Heads up, MSI. It's time to go back to the drawing board on a good chunk of your coding, but heads up to you. If you also own one of them, be on the lookout for updates to your hardware that you're going to want to do. Moving on, let's talk about Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft. Very, very fancy. They are New York's oldest law firm. Now, on a notice of breach, here we are, to their clients on March 30th, this law firm stated that an unauthorized party gained remote access to their network on November 15th of last year. Now, reportedly, the attackers were able to acquire sensitive information on the network, which included documents containing personal information belonging to customers' companies, including names, social security numbers, all that fun stuff. Now, the Office of Maine Attorney General, which is where one of the places they disclosed to, basically said the breach was discovered on November 16th, and 93,211 people were affected. They were founded, for the record, in 1792, and they are the oldest continuing operating legal practice in the entire United States, not just New York. So there you go. But they're obviously based in New York, so there you go. Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft. There you go. I'm guessing what, the great-great-great-great-great-grandkids are running it now? I have no idea. Moving on, let's talk about Twitter, because why not? It's another week, another breach. Now, if you haven't heard, Twitter Circles, which apparently is a thing, I've never used it, is broken. But here's the thing. What happened with this, and maybe it's a coding issue, I don't have much more information, is that apparently some people are claiming that as they are sending stuff that's supposed to be secure and private to them, such as naked photos, were starting to appear in other people's feeds that basically had no rights to see those naked photos. So if you're getting all naked and sending things in Twitter circles, you probably want to stop. That's all I know as of right now. I do not know quantities. I do not know what happened there. That's all I've heard. I've got reports on it. And here we go. Moving on. Let's talk about the city of Modesto, because a recent ransomware attack on their network may have cost them at least $1 million. This is an update for the record from one from a few months ago. It may have cost them at least $1 million for expert help in recovering and for additional security detection and prevention tools that might have deterred the original attackers. And the city council this past Tuesday is expected to approve spending as much as $586,000 for the expert help and $497,000 annually for the security detection and prevention tools. Modesto anticipates that it will be reimbursed by the insurance provider for the cost of the expert help minus the $100,000 deductible. And if you don't recall, the police's IT network was essentially hit on February 3rd by a ransomware attack. The laptops in the patrol vehicles and other technologies were not working, and the report stated it took 5 weeks for them to recover from the attack. That's a really long time to have a miscoordinated police department. Never a good thing. City of Modesto back on their feet, paying the price. And if they had just spent a little bit out of the gate, they wouldn't be in this mess. I've said it a million times before. And finally, and we actually have two finalies for you. The first one is the entire nation of Japan. And that's thanks to Fujitsu, the largest IT provider in the nation. Now, an attack, and I talked about this, on basically Fujitsu is now spilling across the country's corporate sector, with cybersecurity experts warning that it's going to trigger a surge of attempts by organized criminal gangs to extort ransoms from Japanese customers and their customers. More than 10 Japanese companies already have said in the past month that they have been affected by the attack on Fujitsu because it supplies internet infrastructure to thousands of companies across all the islands. Now, the attack took place last year and allowed outside access to emails sent through Fujitsu-based email system. Fujitsu admitted last year that it was hacked, but refused to disclose how many of its customers were targeted. Now, on top of this, Tokio Marine and Nichido Fire, which is one of Japan's largest underwriters of corporate insurance against cyber attacks and also a prime target for ransomware gangs, acknowledged to customers last month that it was one of the companies potentially affected by Fujitsu's leak. Now, the technology giant Kyocera, clothing maker Goldwyn, and property developer Sekisui House, have all said within the past month they are also basically affected by Fujitsu's incident as well. Cybersecurity experts also said the attack on Fujitsu was consistent with the tactics of professionalized gangs in Russia and Belarus who target Japanese companies and organizations because they often have relatively low-level defenses and are willing to pay ransoms, which tend to be high. So we're talking about both Cuba and Lockbit ransomware gangs have been very active in Japan over the past 18 months. We've also seen a lot of work in Australia being happening. So looks like the eastern side of the globe, you know, at least if you're going by east and west, is there. But Japan, obviously, the nationwide, if their largest companies their largest companies keep getting hit, you're looking at essentially in the impact on the entire Japanese population. That's a huge problem. And so hopefully everybody's battening down the hatches. And if you are working for a Japanese company or you own a Japanese company and you are watching or listening to this, spend money on cybersecurity. Do it now, especially if you've ever used Fujitsu. You are on potentially the chopping block here. And finally, just in time for tax season, I'm not kidding, we have to talk about eFile.com's tax return software. They're basically authorized by the IRS to do the work for you, but here's what's going on, and this isn't fun. eFile.com, as I mentioned, authorized. They're authorized by the IRS as an eFile software service. Basically, had malware. Their site had malware. Now, security researchers state that the malicious JavaScript file that existed in the eFile.com website was there for weeks. Bleeping Computer, where I'm pulling this report, was also able to confirm the existence of the JavaScript file at that time. So that security incident specifically confirms, it basically concerns eFile.com, not IRS's eFile infrastructure or identical sounding domains, meaning if you have used eFile.com and that is it, you are potentially caught up in this. Now, if the user that is using the site basically followed the prompts, they would basically download a backdoor into this computer. Now, this is a basic backdoor, but it had enough functionality to give access to your device or computer, allowing a threat actor to basically access, let's say, corporate networks, your home network, whatever it was. These attacks could also be used to deploy malware, steal credentials, spread laterally across whatever network it's on, steal data for extortion, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the scope of this incident, including if the attack successfully infected any eFile customers or visitors, basically, we don't know just yet, but this is going to be a huge one. Now, if you're watching this or listening to this outside of the United States, April 15th is tax day. Basically, we have to, as citizens, file our taxes with the federal government on or before April 15th to make sure that we're not in violation, of tax code or tax law here. And a lot of these sites like eFile.com are incredibly popular. And so the last thing you want to do is have to file for the IRS and then spend like a year and a half unscrewing yourself from an identity theft scam because you filed your taxes. And that's what we're talking about here. Not to mention in the past, the IRS has been hit as well. So that's obviously a huge thing. So we're going to see where this goes. Those were your breaches of the week. It was just an absolute crazy week, as I mentioned. So here we are. And with that, were you affected? Let me know.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And this week's deep dive is basically on the Pentagon leaks. Now, I'm sure you've heard of them. Obviously, a lot's going down with that. But I wrote an article basically very quickly last week that was published on Saturday, April 15th, and basically entitled, "The Pentagon Leaks Would Be Near Impossible to Find Beforehand." And that's the angle that I'm taking here, because you might hear about the leaker, all these things, and how it's spread. But there's a lot of stuff that goes into this. And finding this kind of information is very difficult, even for intelligence agencies or a military. So with that, let's get cracking on this. And I have to get this out of the way immediately, because I just have to say this. We don't know, as of right now, if these documents are entirely legitimate. I don't care what you've read, or heard on the news, et cetera, et cetera. The Pentagon has declared that they believe they have arrested the leaker. I'm not going to mention his name, not going to give him credibility. However, though, without a valid chain of custody, and this is something I have written about and I've talked about extensively through multiple different things, including Hunter Biden's laptop story in a non-political way, Mike Lindell, the My Pillows guy, Cyber Symposium, where he claimed he had evidence, of voter hacking, all that kind of stuff. Without a valid chain of custody, we do not know exactly if the documents that were posted to Discord are the ones that we are now circulating around the world. And remember, we have seen some insanely fantastical claims here about the Israeli government, the French government, South Korea, the United States themselves, that, we also have special forces, in country. Are those actually real? Were those what was actually posted to Discord? Or were those taken by somebody and altered? That's what we're going to talk about. Because the question of, are they real without alterations, meaning whoever put these out to the wider public did not change anything? Or are they real, but they've been tampered with, like one of the early document finds that appeared to have basically switched the death toll numbers in the Ukraine war? That was something, interestingly enough, that Tucker Carlson basically put out there, that said, for one Russian death, seven Ukrainians are dying, when all estimates are exactly the opposite of that. And he got that, interestingly enough, from a Russian disinformation podcast account that was recently found out as well. On top of it, could these be well-done fakes that are basically riffing off the original Discord leaks? We don't know. It's speculation right now. The Washington Post shared an article when all of this broke that the Discord user alleged to be the leaker, basically was an account from a friend, meaning they interviewed a quote-unquote friend or somebody else that was part of this Discord server, and there you go. The legitimacy of the leaked documents and the person's motivation, quite frankly, are uncertain right now. And as a cyber forensics expert, I could not testify in court without a proper chain of custody and more information than what's currently available in news reports. And so then, if these were real, why didn't the Department of Defense immediately get alerted that their highly classified data was put out on the internet for a bunch of gamers to see in a Discord channel? And the answer is more complicated than you think. And that's why we're talking about this today, because this is an important one to understand just how difficult this is for even the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, the world's most sophisticated military. And here we are now. And we're going to start with Discord, because for the record, it's pretty much impossible to monitor it fully, unlike Facebook could be or would be. With Facebook, anything a user does, like connect to a friend or join a group, can be seen by Facebook relatively easily. So, for example, if I created a closed Facebook group called Let's Leak Pentagon Documents and only invited, let's say, three of my closest friends, the only people that are going to see that group are myself, my three friends, and something like 80,000 Facebook employees, since Facebook is basically structured to centralize administration. Now, they're not that good at monitoring, but the point is they would be able to find that significantly easy if the courts came a-knocking or law enforcement came a-knocking. Discord, though, is quasi-decentralized. That means anybody can right now, you, I, anybody, can go start a Discord server for any purpose. And unless you know where that server is, how to get there, and then be accepted by the administrator of that server, assuming they've got like a vetting and challenge process, you're not going to see any content within that server. And Discord isn't recommending it to you as basically a group to join like Facebook does through their advertising. If you're joined to a Facebook group, let's say, I don't know, we'll use an easy one, on cars, then they're going to start suggesting more groups for you to join on, you know, whatever cars. Oh, you own a Subaru or Mercedes or whatever, you know, they're going to start giving you groups for Subarus or Mercedes or Yugos, you know, whatever you own. Now, according to Discord themselves, it is logistically impossible for them to monitor everything. And their policy is to not monitor what happens within these servers by default. So you've got a whole bunch of stuff. And in other words, if law enforcement shows up with a warrant, Discord itself would have a much more difficult time identifying which server law enforcement needed, unless the warrant was very specific and named the server directly instead of, let's say, the content they were looking for that could be anywhere within that ecosystem. Now, for the record, there are many legitimate uses for Discord. Gamers obviously go there to chat with each other, live stream their games, send messages, etc. But many people and organizations also set up Discord servers and accounts for other reasons. For example, if you didn't know, I'm also the president of a nonprofit, the Foundation for a Human Internet. We use Discord to coordinate with our volunteers. Everybody from bird watching groups to flat earthers and everybody in between can set up shop at Discord and basically create their own ecosystems for like-minded people. Unfortunately, though, Discord has also been a haven for extremism. Now, that is shifting, for the record, over to Telegram, which is much more encrypted. It's considered more private. But Discord was the home to the Topps supermarket shooter in Buffalo, New York. If you remember that, he streamed his drive off a GoPro camera on his helmet to the supermarket and then basically continued to live stream his horrific executions of innocent people inside. 15 people joined his live stream on Discord to watch the terror unfold in real time. And then the video eventually made the rounds basically on the worst of the worst of the internet and was viewed millions of times. One of the things we do in my company is go looking, you know, for these kinds of issues when these situations come up. And we found that video and it is absolutely horrific. And if that shooting proves anything, it's that all it takes is one of those 15 people watching it in real time to copy it and then put it out to the greater public sphere. And this Pentagon leak is no different. So unless the arrested suspect also spread these documents elsewhere, one of the core questions has to be, if he didn't go beyond posting it to Discord, then which other member of that Discord server disseminated that further? Discord itself has an extremist problem, and they've had it for years. Neo-Nazis, extremists, and others all use Discord to hang out and talk and collaborate on basically, you know, future violence or crimes. If you didn't know the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville that is basically the neo-Nazis showed up to, you might remember them chanting, "Jews will not replace us," all this kind of stuff that led to a whole bunch of violence that day, not to mention the death of an innocent, Heather Heyer. Even searching for Discord servers right now, if you know where to go on Google and just look for various Discord servers, keyword terms like jihad also show active servers promoting their version of extremism. And so unlike standard messaging boards, like, you know, the defunct 4chan, the revamped 8kun, which is basically birthed after 4chan, this is where all the shooters post their manifesto, Discord, though, offers extremism the ability to form an online community where members feel more comfortable expressing themselves more freely and opening up about who they are. 4chan, you can go on anonymously, you don't know who's watching, but these Discord servers are closed and have vetting, and since most of these servers have that vetting process, its members are more comfortable being expressive. Plus, like the Topps supermarket shooter in Buffalo, New York, it also connects them with like-minded people who encourage this behavior. Shooters, as I mentioned, posting manifestos to 4chan and 8chan, that's unfortunately common, but on Discord, you can live stream your rampage and get encouragement from your deranged followers in real time. Combine that with the near anonymity and invisibility that a Discord server brings to the table, and even the Pentagon simply could not monitor the entirety of that infrastructure for specific leaks from specific people. Now, Discord is not the only issue in this situation, though. The next are the documents themselves. There were reports that these documents appeared to be pictures of actual documents, not direct copies of files like PDFs or Word documents. Apparently, these leaked documents had visible folds, which increased their credibility, interestingly enough, and here's why. Now, in the wake of the Edward Snowden leak case back in 2013-2014, the Department of Defense, like the NSA, CIA, etc., would have implemented new security controls on their digital classified data so they could no longer simply be copied onto something like a flash drive and then walked out of the building. Cybersecurity professionals, we've been building these ecosystems for years, and so here are some of the key defensive approaches that are taken to basically prevent documents from being leaked or stolen. So the first one up is a DLP, or data loss prevention system. This is the core of what we are talking about here, putting systems in a place that read and understand the information being sent in and out of an organization is critical to stop the accidental and intentional leak when they happen. So at the most basic level, think of like an email platform for business, like Microsoft Office 365. They actually have data loss prevention baked in for customers. If you're a customer, you can turn it on and start using it. So for example, suppose an employee were to fall for a phishing scam and attempted to send out their credit card information via email. Okay, you know, Prince Ubuntu really does need your help with his revolution, and you're sending them your credit card information. In this case, if you're on Office 365, Microsoft's artificial intelligence will read the email. And if the credit card information is included, it will look at it, sense it, and then it will block it from actually being sent outside of the organization while alerting the proper staff. So, oh God, Bob in accounting fell for the Nigerian print scam again, tried to send his credit card, Microsoft blocked it, and now he has to go back into training because the IT or cybersecurity department basically was alerted to this. Intelligence agencies are going to have this in place. And so if I were, let's say, in an intelligence agency, I'd be caught if I tried to email a classified document. On top of this, many ecosystems, also under the umbrella of data loss prevention, have digital rights management solutions, also known as DRM. These are in place to prevent the removal of digital files. Essentially, that classified PDF or Word doc or whatever is now tagged with a unique cryptographic signature that only allows authorized computers or devices to open it. And so, for example, if I were to copy out a document, let's say on that flash drive, I brought it home, I tried to open it on my home computer, I wouldn't be able to. My home computer would not be part of that cryptographically secured ecosystem. There would be a log in the corporate system or in the Pentagon or wherever I work of basically me copying it onto a flash drive, but that file is encrypted. So if I lose the flash drive, the data is still protected. If I try to open it at home, let's say I legitimately just want to keep working, you know, even though I have been trained that that's illegal, you know, now they know, and it's not going to be basically falling into hands. I couldn't go post it on Discord or anywhere else. Now, this leads us to the third and final point, which is the more concerning one here, because basically of the folds in the actual paper. The folds in the actual paper alert us to an issue with both physical security and training. All Pentagon personnel, just like NSA, CIA, DIA, take your pick, all Pentagon personnel are trained in the proper handling of sensitive and classified information. They know it can only be handled in designated areas like SCIFs, secure compartmented information facilities, and that outside technology like personal phones is forbidden. I cannot walk in to a classified facility with my iPhone or my Android. That would essentially be stowed away before I would be able to enter. They understand, these employees understand the disciplinary and criminal actions against them if they break these rules because they're breaking the law. And they're required to sign off on them, meaning as I start up with the Pentagon, you know, here we are. I'm going through classified document handling classes and all of that. I am signing off to say I, Nick Espinoza, employee, soldier, whatever I am, essentially understand that I would be arrested or tried and convicted or whatever for basically taking classified documents where I'm not allowed to. The wild card here, though, and this is always a wild card in these situations, is the motivation of the person. Knowing the consequences, basically, you know, if I know the consequences and I fail, if that fails to be a deterrent for whatever reason, maybe that person is deeming those documents more important to get out to the world than the actual jail time they would face. Edward Snowden would be an example of that. Edward Snowden knew exactly what he was doing was illegal, which is why he basically absconded. He left the country, went to Hong Kong, and now he's sitting in Russia. I believe he's formerly a Russian citizen now, which happened, I think, in 2022, et cetera, et cetera. But that's what we are talking about here. In this particular case, though, physical security clearly failed because a device was with a camera was allowed near classified material. Again, that's assuming that the original documents posted were legit. The original ones on Discord seem legit. It's the dissemination after that that we just don't know 100%. And to be honest, we're not 100% on the Discord dumps either, but it does look legitimate given the charges that have been filed. Now, whether a camera was smuggled into a secure doc, you know, secure area to take these pictures, or these documents were folded, basically hidden on the perpetrator's body and then removed from the facility, which is the most likely scenario here, physical security was bypassed in some way.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.